horrific as the Gray Man or the many-mouthed thing, I was beginning to realize that there was no such thing as an attractive Unseelie.
"Not true," Baron said when I remarked upon it. "Unseelie royalty, the princes and princesses of the four houses, are every bit as inhumanly beautiful as Seelie royalty. In fact, it is virtually impossible to tell them apart."
"Why are there so many Unseelie here?"
"Morbidity is their oxygen, Miss Lane. They breathe richly in places like this."
We had been navigating a maze of subterranean corridors for some time. Now we turned down a long, dim hallway that ended in an immense, square black door belted by bands of steel. A dozen men stood guard between Melush and any of his two fervent faithful, shoulders slung with ammunition, toting automatic weapons. A large bull of a man with a shaved head stepped into our path, blocking our way. The safety pins in his ears didn't bother me. The ones in his eyelids did.
"Where do you think you're going?"
he growled, fixing his rifle on Baron's with one hand, resting the heel of the other on the butt of a gun tucked into the waistband of his black leather pants.
"Inform Melush that Jericho Barons is here."
"Why would the master give a fuck?"
"I have something he wants."
"Oh, yeah? Like what?"
Baron smiled, and for the first time I saw a glint of genuine humor in his dark eyes.
"Tell him to try to access any of his bank accounts."
10 minutes later, the door to Melusha's inner sanctum burst open. The shaven-headed messenger stumbled out, his face ashen, his shirt covered with blood. He was followed by two Unseelie rhino boys who jammed guns into our sides and marched us through the doorway and into the vampire's lair. Nausea flooded my stomach, and I gripped my purse tightly with both hands so I wouldn't inadvertently touch either of our ugly escorts. The chamber beyond the steel-belted door was so sumptuously decorated in velveteens, satins, gauzes, and brocades, and so busily furnished in neo-Victorian that it was difficult at first to locate our host in the clutter. It didn't help that his attire matched his surroundings, the very height of romantic goth. I spotted him at last, motionless on a low-backed, richly embellished chaise scattered with gilt pillows and tasseled throws. Melush was wearing stiff, textured brown and black-striped trousers and fine-tooled Italian slippers. His eggshell linen shirt dripped lace at his wrists and throat, and blood at his jabot. He wore a brocade and velvet vest of amber, russet, crimson, and gold, and as I watched, he withdrew a snowy handkerchief from a pocket in the inner lining and gently dabbed blood from his chin, then licked a few remaining drops from his lips. Muscular and graceful as a cat, he was pale and smooth as a marble bust. Dead yellow eyes lent a feral cast to his sharply chiseled, too white face. Long blonde hair pulled back in an old-fashioned, amber-beaded queue emphasized his abnormally rigid pallor. The vampire separated sinuously from the settee and rose, holding an incongruously modern laptop. With a graceful flick of his fingers, he snapped the chrome case shut, tossed it carelessly on a velvet-draped table, then glided to a halt in front of us. As he stood there in all his undead stillness, face to face with the carnal maleness and disturbing vitality of Jericho Barons, I was startled to realize that, although I was deep in the belly of a vampire's lair, surrounded by his worshippers and monster minions, if pressed to decide which of the men before me was more dangerous, it wouldn't have been Melush. Eyes narrowed, I looked back and forth between them. Something nagged at me, something I couldn't quite put my finger on. It was a thing that I would stupidly fail to put my finger on until it was too late. Before long, I would understand that nothing had been what it seemed that night, and the reason Barons had faced off so coolly with the blood-sucking master was because he'd gone in with the quiet assurance that, no matter what happened, he would walk out alive, and not because he had Melush by the proverbial fiscal balls.
"What did you do with my money?"
the vampire inquired, his silken voice unmatched by the steel in his strange citron eyes. Barons laughed, teeth flashing white in his dark face.
"Think of it as an insurance policy.
I'll return it when we're through Johnstone.
The vampire's lips drew back, revealing long, sharp, pointed fangs. There was still blood on them. An expression of utter, mindless rage flashed over his icy face.
The name's Malouche, asshole,
he hissed. Score one for Barons, I thought. J.J. Jr. still hated his name. Losing control of an immense fortune didn't seem to bother him nearly as much as merely being addressed by the name with which he'd been christened. Barons flicked a contemptuous gaze over the vampire, from frothy, bloody jabot to pointy-toed, silk-trimmed leather slippers.
Malouche asshole,
he repeated.
And here I thought your middle name was Fashion Nightmare.
Malouche's inhuman yellow eyes narrowed.
Do you have a death wish, human?
He'd recovered quickly. His face was blank again, his voice once more controlled, so light and melodic it was nearly a verbal caress. Barons laughed again.
Might. Doubt you'll be helping me with it, though. What do you know about the Shisadu, Junior?
Malouche flinched, almost imperceptibly, but it was there. If I hadn't been watching him so closely, I wouldn't have caught it. Twice now he'd betrayed an emotion, a thing I was willing to bet he rarely did. With a glance at his guards, then to the door, he said,
Out. Except you.
He pointed at Barons. Barons wrapped an arm around my shoulder, and I instantly shivered, just as I had last night when he touched me. The man packed a seriously weird physical punch.
She stays with me,
Barons said. Malouche gave me a deprecating once-over. Slowly, very slowly, his lips curved. The smile didn't work with those chilling, dead animal eyes of his.
Someone certainly took that Passé Rolling Stones song to heart, didn't they?
He murmured. Everyone's a fashion critic. I knew which song he meant, She's a Rainbow. Whenever I listened to it on my iPod, I would close my eyes and spin around, pretending I was in a sun-dappled clearing, with my arms spread wide and my head thrown back, while colors of every hue sprayed from my fingertips like brilliant little airbrush guns, painting trees, birds, bees, and flowers, even the sun in the sky, glorious shades. I loved that song. When I didn't answer him, Barons and I might have reached an agreement about how he would and wouldn't refer to me, but I was still under orders to keep my mouth shut. Malouche turned to his bodyguards, who hadn't moved an inch, and hissed,
I said out.
The two unseelie looked at each other. Then one spoke in a gravelly voice.
But, oh great undead one, you've got to be kidding me, Junior,
Barons muttered, shaking his head.
Couldn't you come up with something a little more original?
Now!
When Malouche bared his fangs at them, the Rhino Boy bodyguards left, but they didn't look at all happy about it. 13.
Well, that was a pure waste of time,
Barons growled as we picked our way back through the antique furnishings and all-too-modern morals of Malouche's house. I didn't say anything. The unseelie Rhino boys were right behind us, making sure we left. The master was not at all happy with us. Once he had dismissed his guards, Malouche had simply pretended not to know what Barons was talking about, acting as if he'd never heard of the Shisadu before, even though a blind man could see that not only had he, but he knew something about it that disturbed him deeply. He and Barons had gotten into a pissing match, trading barbs and insults, and within moments they'd completely forgotten about me. 10 minutes or so into their little testosterone war, one of Malouche's guards, one of the human ones, had been stupid enough to interrupt, and I'd seen something that had convinced me J.J. Jr. was the genuine article, or at least something supernatural. The vampire had picked up the nearly 7-foot bruiser with one pale hand around his throat, raised him in the air, and flung him backward across the chamber so hard he'd slammed into a wall, slumped to the floor, and lay there, his head lolling at an impossible angle on his chest, blood leaking from his nose and ears. Then he'd stood there, his yellow eyes blazing unnaturally, and for a moment I'd been afraid he was going to fall slathering on the bloody bundle and feast. Time to go, I thought, on the verge of hysteria. But Behrens had said something nasty, and he and Malouche had gotten right back into it, so I'd stood there hugging myself against the awfulest chill, tapping a foot nervously, and trying not to throw up. The Rhino boys didn't leave us at the door, but escorted us all the way to the Porsche and waited while we got inside. They were still standing there with their valet buddy as we sped away. I watched them in my side-view mirror until they disappeared from sight, then heaved a huge sigh of relief. That had been singularly the most nerve-wracking experience of my life, surpassing even my encounter with the hideous many-mouthed thing. "Tell me we never have to go back there again," I said to Behrens, blotting clammy palms on my skirt.
"But we do, Miss Lane. We didn't get the chance to cover the grounds. We'll have to return in a day or two for a thorough look around."
"There's nothing on the grounds," I told him. He glanced at me.
"You can't know that. Malusha's estate covers hundreds of acres."
I sighed. I had no doubt if Behrens had his way, he'd run me over every dratted inch of it, back and forth, his own indefatigable psychic lint brush. "There's nothing on the grounds, Behrens," I repeated.
"Again, Miss Lane, you can't know that. You didn't start sensing the photocopies of the Shisadu until I'd removed them from the vault 3 floors beneath the garage and brought them into the bookstore."
I blinked. "There are 3 floors beneath the garage? Why on earth?" Behrens locked his jaw as if he regretted the admission. I could see I was going to get nothing further from him on the subject, so I pressed my point instead. I was not going back to the vampire's den. Not tomorrow, not the day after tomorrow, not even next week. If they caught me, they'd kill me. Of that I was certain. I'd not exactly been discreet. "I don't agree," I said. "I think Malouche would keep anything he valued nearby. He would want it close at hand, to pull it out and gloat over it, if nothing else." Behrens slanted me a sideways look.
"Now you're an expert on Malouche?"
"Not an expert, but I think I know a thing or two," I said defensively.
"And why is that, Ms. Rainbow?"
"He was such a jackass sometimes." I shrugged it off because it was only going to make this next part even sweeter. It had almost been worth leaving my on-the-go cosmetics pack Mom had given me, my brush, my favorite pink fingernail polish, and 2 candy bars on a table in the vampire's den, just to see the look on Behrens's face when I unzipped my purse, withdrew an enameled black box, held it up, and waggled it at him. "Because that was where this used to be," I said smugly. "Close at hand." Behrens shifted down and slammed on the brake so hard the tires squealed and the pads smoked. "I did good. Go ahead and say it, Behrens," I encouraged. "I did good, didn't I? Not only could I sense the Shisadu, apparently I could sense all fey objects of power, or oops for short, as I would soon be calling them, and I was darned proud of myself for how neatly I'd purloined my first. We'd returned to the bookstore at just slightly under the speed of light, and were now seated in the rear conversation area where he was examining the spoils of my novice kill.
"Short of leaving your calling card on the table for all to see, Miss Lane," he said, turning the elaborate box in his hands, "which was beyond idiotic. I suppose one could say at least you didn't get yourself killed. Yet."
I snorted. But I suspected damned by faint praise was probably the best anyone ever got from Jericho Behrens. When we'd smoked to a stop in the middle of the road, not nearly far enough from Malusha's lair, and I'd confessed to having left a few personal items behind, he'd jammed the Porsche into gear again, and we'd raced the moon back to the city. "I didn't have a choice," I said for the umpteenth time. "I told you I couldn't fit it in my purse otherwise." I glared at him, but he had eyes only for the oop, which he was trying to figure out how to open. "Next time I'll know better and just leave it," I said crossly. "Would that make you happier?" He glanced up, his dark gaze dripping icy old-world hauteur.
"That's not what I meant, Miss Lane, and you know it."
I imitated his expression and shot it back at him. Then don't berate me for doing something the only way it could be done, Barons. I couldn't figure out a way to smuggle it out beneath my skirt, and I could hardly stuff it down my bra. His gaze flicked to my chest and stayed there a moment. When he returned his attention to the box, I caught my breath and stared blankly at the top of his dark head. Barons had just given me the most carnal, sexually charged, hungry look I'd ever seen in my life, and I was pretty sure he didn't even know he'd done it. My breasts felt hot and flushed, and my mouth was suddenly uncomfortably dry. Jericho Barons might be only 7 or 8 years older than me, and he might be what most women would consider extremely attractive in a dark, forbidding way, but he and I came from different worlds. We didn't see life the same way. Gazelles didn't lie down with lions, at least not unbloodied and alive. After a long, puzzled moment, I shook my head, thrust the inexplicable look from my mind, there was simply no room for it in my reality, and employed a swift change of subject. So what is it? Any idea? The feeling I got from it wasn't the same as the one I'd gotten from the photocopies of the She Sedue. Though I'd begun feeling nauseated the instant I'd stepped into the chamber, it hadn't approached incapacitating, not even when I'd located and stood right next to the thing. I'd taken advantage of Barron's and Melusha's ridiculous posturing and made my stealthy swap. Handling the box hadn't been pleasant, but I'd been able to contend with my queasy stomach.
"If it's what I think it is," Barron's replied, "it's nearly as important as the Dark Book itself, indispensable to us."
"Ah," he said with satisfaction,
"there you are."
With tiny, steely clicks, the box popped open. I leaned forward and peered inside. There, on a bed of black velvet, lay a translucent blue-black stone that looked as if it had been cleaved in sharp, clean strokes from a much larger one. Both the smooth outer surfaces and rough inner faces were covered with raised, rune-like lettering. The stone emitted an eerie blue glow that deepened to coal at its outer edges. I got an icy chill just from looking at it.
"Ah, yes, Miss Lane,"
Barons murmured.
"You are indeed to be commended. Maladroit methods aside, we now have 2 of the 4 sacred stones necessary to unravel the secrets of the She Sedue."
"I see only one," I said.
"I have its mate inside my vault."
He traced his fingers lightly over the raised surface of the faintly humming stone. "Why is it making that noise?" I was beginning to feel a great deal of curiosity about just what else might be tucked away beneath Barons's garage.
"It must sense the proximity of its counterpart. It is said if the 4 are brought together again, they will sing a song of making."
"You mean they'll create something?" I asked. Barron shrugged.
"There are no words in the Fey language equivalent to create or destroy. There is only making, which also includes the unmaking of a thing."
"That's odd," I said. "They must have a very limited language."
"What they have, Miss Lane, is a very precise language. If you think about it a moment, you'll see it makes sense. Case in point, if you're making sense, you've just unmade confusion."
"Huh?" My confusion hadn't been unmade. In fact, I could feel it deepening.
"In order to make something, Miss Lane, you must first unmake what is in the process. Should you begin with nothing, even nothing is unmade when it is replaced with something. To the 2 a day, there is no difference between creating and destroying. There is only stasis and change."
I'm a bottom-line girl. I barely managed C's in my college philosophy courses. When I tried to read Jean-Paul Sartre's Being and Nothingness, I developed an unshakable case of narcolepsy that attacked every 2 to 3 paragraphs, resulting in deep, coma-like fits of sleep. The only thing I remember about Kafka's Metamorphosis is the awful apple that got impacted in the bug's back. And Borges's stupid story about the avatar and the tortoise didn't teach me a thing, except how much better I like Little Bunny Fufu. It rhymes, and you can jump rope to it. The way I saw it, what Barons had just told me was this. A fairy not only wouldn't care whether I lived or died, it wouldn't even really register that I was dead, just that before I could walk and talk and change my clothes by myself, but afterward I couldn't, as if someone had yanked the batteries out of me. It occurred to me that I could really learn to hate the Fae. With a muttered apology to my mom, I snatched up a shredded pillow, hurled it across the ransacked bedroom, and cried, "Damn, damn, damn! Where did you put it, Alina?" Feathers showered the room. What remained intact of the slashed-up pillow crashed into a framed picture of a thatched-roofed seaside cottage above the headboard, one of the few items in her apartment that had been left undisturbed, and knocked it off the wall. Fortunately, it fell on the bed and the glass didn't break. Unfortunately, it didn't reveal a convenient hidey-hole. I sank to the floor and leaned back against the wall, staring up at the ceiling, waiting for inspiration to strike. It didn't. I'd run out of ideas. I had checked every place Alina had ever hidden a journal at home, and then some, with no luck. Not only hadn't I found her journal, I'd discovered a few other things missing as well. Her photo albums and her floral-paged Franklin planner were gone. Alina carried her planner as faithfully as she wrote in her journal, and I knew she had two photo albums in Dublin, one of our family and home in Ashford to show to new friends, and a blank one to fill while she was there. I'd had no luck finding any of them, and I'd done a thorough search. I'd even stopped at a hardware store on the way over and bought a hammer, so I could tear apart the baseboard in her bedroom closet. I'd ended up using the claw handle to pry at all the moldings and casings in the place, looking for loose trim. I'd tapped at the wood nooks and crannies of the fireplace facade. I'd hammered at floor planks, listening for hollow spots. I'd examined every piece of furniture in the place, tops, sides, and bottoms, and even checked inside as well as beneath the toilet tank. I had found nothing. If her journal was hidden somewhere in the apartment, she'd outdone me this time. The only thing left for me to try was complete demolition of the place, smashing out the walls, ripping off the cabinets, and tearing up the floors, at which point I'd have to buy the darned building just to pay for all the damages, and I didn't have that kind of money. I caught my breath. But Barron's did. And I could offer him an incentive to want to find her notebook. I wanted Alina's journal for the clues it might hold to the identity of her killer, but there was a good possibility it also contained information about the location of the Shi Sidhu. After all, the last thing my sister had said in her message was, "I know what it is now, and I know where," before her words had abruptly terminated. The odds were high she'd written something about it in her diary. The question was, could I trust Jericho Barron's, and if so, how far? I stared into space, wondering what I really knew about him. It wasn't much. The darkly exotic half-Basque, half-picked, was a self-contained mystery I was willing to bet he never let anyone get close enough to unravel. Fiona might know a thing or two about him, but she was a mystery herself. I knew this much. He was going to be royally pissed at me by the time he saw me again, because the last thing he'd said to me, in his typical high-handed manner, before I'd stumbled exhaustedly off to bed early this morning, was, "I have things to do tomorrow, Miss Lane. You will remain in the bookstore until I return. Fiona will procure anything you might need." I'd ignored his orders, and shortly after I'd awakened at 2:30 in the afternoon, slipped out the back way, down the alley behind the store. No, I wasn't being stupid, and I didn't have a death wish. What I had was a mission, and I couldn't afford to let fear shut me down, or I might as well reserve the first seat available on the next flight back to Georgia, tuck tail and run home to the safety of Mom and Dad. Yes, I knew the many-mouthed thing was out there looking for the blonder, fluffier version of me. Yes, I had no doubt that while Malouche slumbered his daylight hours away, tucked in a garish, romantic goth coffin somewhere, dripping blood-encrusted lace, his men were already scouring Dublin for the thieving Ms. Rainbow. But nobody would be looking for this me. I was incognito. I'd scraped my dark hair tightly back into a short ponytail and tucked it up beneath a ball cap, pulled down low. I was wearing my favorite faded jeans, a sloppy, oversized, nearly threadbare T-shirt I'd swiped from Dad before I left that had once been black a few hundred washings ago, and scuffed-up tennis shoes. I didn't have on a single accessory, and I'd used a brown paper bag as a purse. I'd applied no makeup, zip, zilch, nada, not even lipstick, even though my mouth felt really weird without it. I'm pretty addicted to moisturizers. I think it comes from living in the heat of the South. Even the best skin needs a little extra care down there. But the crowning triumph of my disguise was a truly hideous pair of magnifying spectacles I'd purchased at a drugstore on the way over that I currently had hooked on the neck of my dingy tee. You might not think it sounds like much of a disguise, but I know a thing or two about people. The world notices pretty, well-dressed young women, and it tries real hard not to see the unattractive, sloppy ones. If you're bad enough, you get the thousand-yard stare that slides right off you. There was no doubt that I looked worse than I'd ever looked in my life. I wasn't proud of it, yet at the same time I was. I might never manage ugly, but at least I bordered on invisible. I glanced at my watch and pushed to my feet. I'd been searching Alina's place for hours. It was nearly 7. Baron seemed to have a habit of showing up at the bookstore shortly after 8, and I wanted to be back before he arrived tonight. I knew Fiona would rat me out anyway, but I figured he wouldn't be half as irritated if his personal oop detector had already returned safe and sound by the time he showed up, as he would be if I left him to stew over the potential loss of it for a while. I collected my paper bag purse, stuck the awful glasses back on my nose, pulled my ball cap down as low as it would go, turned out the lights, and locked up. The air was warm, the sky streaked with the orange and crimson of a magnificent sunset when I stepped from the building. It was going to be a beautiful Midsummer's Eve in Dublin. Alina's place and Baron's were on opposite ends of the busy Temple Bar district, but I didn't mind that I had to push through crowds of festive pub-goers to get back to the bookstore. I might not be happy myself, but it was kind of nice to see others who were. It made me feel more optimistic about my own chances. As I hurried down the cobbled streets, not a single person spared me a glance. I was pleased with my invisibility, and determinedly tuning out my increasingly alien and depressing world by tuning into my iPod. I was listening to one of my favorite one-hit wonders, Laid, by James. This bed is on fire with passionate love. The neighbors complain about the noises above, but she only comes when she's on top. When I saw it, I wanted to fuck the moment I laid eyes on it. I told you before, cuss words don't come easily to me, especially not that particular one, so you can see the measure of the phase impact that the word marched into my mind and assumed immediate control of the front. Ego and superego were dispatched with a single swift killing blow, and in swaggered my new ruler, that primitive little hedonistic bastard, the id. I was instantly wet, hot, and slippery in my panties, every cell ripe and swollen with need. My breasts and loins plumped just from looking at it, grew soft, fuller, heavier. The friction of my nipples against my bra was suddenly an unthinkable sexual torture device, my panties more binding than ropes and chains, and I needed desperately to have something between my legs, pounding into me, cramming me full inside. I needed friction. I needed thick, hot, long, rough friction pushing in and pulling out, pushing in and pulling out over and over. Oh, God, please, I needed something. Nothing else would stop my pain. Nothing else would satisfy my sole purpose in life, to fuck. My clothes were an offense to my skin. I needed them off. I grabbed the bottom of my T-shirt and began to pull it over my head. The breeze on my naked skin startled me. I froze, my shirt half over my face. What in the world was I doing? My sister was dead, buried and rotting in a grave outside the church we'd gone to since we were children, the church we'd both dreamed of one day getting married in. She never would. Because of a fae, I had no doubt. After the events of the past few days, I was certain one or several of them had been responsible for her brutal murder. for ripping and tearing into her with their teeth and claws, and for God only knew what else they'd done to her. No, the coroner hadn't found semen inside her, but what he had found inside her he'd not been able to explain. Most of the time I tried not to think about it too much. "I don't think so," I hissed, yanking my shirt back down. I took advantage of that moment to pluck the earbuds from my ears as well. Listening to James sing about obsessive-compulsive sex was proving the equivalent of tossing gas on an open flame. "Whatever it is you're doing to me, you can just turn it off. It's a waste of your time."
"It is nothing I do, Shesir,"
it said.
"It is what I am. I am every erotic dream you've ever had, and a thousand more you've never thought of. I am sex that will turn you inside out and burn you down to ashes."
It smiled.
"And if I choose, I can make you whole again."
Its voice was deep, rich and melodic, and had all the impact of a soft, sensual suckling at my swollen nipples. The erotic inferno began to rage inside me again. I backed away, straight into the window of the pub behind me. I pressed against it, shivering. Alina is dead because of one of these things. I clung to that thought like a lifeboat. The Fae stood in the middle of the cobbled street, 15 to 20 feet away from me, making no move to approach farther.
This is the end of disc number 4. Please continue listening on disc number 5. This is disc number 5.
The Fae stood in the middle of the cobbled street, 15 to 20 feet away from me, making no move to approach farther. Cars were prohibited in this part of the district, and those pedestrians crossing the street were detouring placidly around it without giving it a second glance. Nor was anyone looking at me, which I wouldn't have found particularly interesting except that I had my T-shirt up again and was flashing the world my favorite pink lace push-up bra as well as most of my breasts. Inhaling sharply, I yanked my shirt back down. Even today, after all that I've seen, I couldn't begin to describe Blaine, Prince of the Tuatha De Dona. There are some things that are simply too immense, too rich to be contained in words. This is the best I can offer. Imagine a tall, powerful, mighty archangel, frighteningly male, terrifyingly beautiful. Then paint him the most exquisite shades of chestnut, bronze, and gold you can possibly imagine. Give him a mane shimmering with strands of cinnamon gilded by sunlight, skin of tawny velvet, and eyes of liquid amber kissed by molten gold. The Fae was unutterably beautiful. And I wanted to fuck and fuck and fuck until I died. I understood then. Each Fae I'd encountered so far had a thing, its own personal calling card. The gray man stole beauty. The shades sucked life. The many-mouthed thing most likely devoured flesh. This one was death by sex, immolation by orgasm. The worst of it was that its victim would be fully aware with some distant part of her brain that she was dying, even as she begged and pleaded for the very thing that was killing her. I had a sudden, horrific vision of myself right there on the street, naked, pathetic, writhing with insatiable need at the thing's feet, invisible to passers-by, dying like that. Never. I had one hope. If I could get close enough, I could freeze it and run. Stealing my will with the hellish memory of how Alina had looked the day I'd identified her body, I peeled myself from the window and stepped forward. The Fae stepped back. I blinked.
"Huh?" "Not retreat, human,"
it said coldly.
"Impatience. I know what you are, Shesir. We need not play your silly game of tag."
"Oh, right," I snapped. "But we sure were going to take the time to play your silly game of death by sex, weren't we?" It shrugged.
"I would not have killed you. You have value to us.
When it smiled at me, I went blank for a heartbeat, as if the sun had come out from behind clouds to shine down only on me. But it was so hot that it charred all my wiring.
"I would have given you only the pleasure of my magnificence,"
it told me.
"Not the pain. We can do that, you know."
I trembled at the thought. All that heat, but no eyes. All that sex, but no death. The night air felt suddenly cool on the scorching skin of my breasts, frigid to the fire of my nipples. I glanced down. My shirt and bra were lying in the gutter at my feet, mixed with the daily trash and grime of the city. Jaw set, hands shaking, I bent to retrieve my clothing. Blushing half-dozen shades of red, I put my bra back on and pulled my shirt over my head again. I reclaimed my paper bag purse and my iPod from the gutter as well, jammed my ball cap back on my head, but didn't bother fishing out my hideous glasses. I didn't want the thing looking any larger than it already did. Then, without hesitation, I stood and lunged straight for the fae. I had to freeze it. It was my only hope. God only knew what I might do next. Before I was able to reach it, however, it vanished. One moment it was there, the next it was gone. I was pretty sure I had just witnessed Faye sifting firsthand. But where had it gone?
"Behind you, human,"
it said. I turned sharply to find it standing on the sidewalk, a dozen feet to my left, pedestrians parting around it like the Red Sea drawing back from Moses, giving it increasingly wider berth. In fact, foot traffic on the entire street seemed to be thinning substantially, and here and there a pub door suddenly slammed closed against a distinctly unsummery chill in the July air.
"We do not have time for fool's play, Michaela Lane."
I jerked. "How do you know my name?"
"We know much about you, Null,"
it said.
"You are one of the most powerful she-seers we've yet encountered. And we believe you have only begun to realize your potential."
"Who are we?" I demanded.
"Those of us who are concerned with the future of both our worlds."
"And who would these those be?"
"I am Blaine, Prince of the Tour de Dana, and I am here on behalf of Avil, exalted High Queen of our race. She has a task for you, she-seer."
I barely resisted the urge to burst out laughing. The last thing I'd have expected to hear from any fae was something along the lines of, "Your mission, should you choose to accept it." On the off chance that you've forgotten, not that I'm trying to remind you or anything, but aren't the fae more inclined to kill she-seers than to assign them helpful little tasks?
"We haven't made examples of your kind for some time now,"
it said.
"As a gesture of our goodwill and a token of the Queen's esteem, we have a gift for you."
"Oh, no," I shook my head. "No gifts, thank you." I was familiar with the whole Trojan horse beware of Greeks bearing gifts debacle, and there was no doubt in my mind that a fae bearing gifts would certainly be worse.
"It is my understanding you have betrayed yourself to one or more of the Unseelie,"
it said coolly. I stiffened. How did it know? And what did it mean by "or more"? Had the royal hunters been alerted too? So, I shrugged, falling back on my best last defense, bluffing.
"Our gift offers you no small protection from those who would harm you."
"Including you?" I blurted, though I'd been managing to hold my own in conversation with it, and believe me, with what I was feeling, it was hard enough to string together consecutive words, to say nothing of trying to make them intelligible. Twice now I'd had to pull my shirt back down, and I just caught myself unzipping my jeans.
"There is no protection against one such as I, she-seer. We of the royal houses affect humans in this manner. There is nothing that can be done to prevent it."
One day I would know that for the lie it was, but not before I'd been burned by the truth in it. "Then what good is your stupid gift?" Crossly, I hooked my bra again. My breasts were so hot and tight they hurt. I cupped one in each hand, squeezed and kneaded, but my desperate massage provided no relief.
Our gift would allow you to defend against many who would kill you, just not against those with the right to kill you.
My eyes narrowed, and my hands dropped to my sides where they fisted. My nails gouged half-moon crescents on my palms. "The right to kill me?" I snapped. Was that what they'd thought of my sister, the ones who had murdered her? That they'd had the right? It studied me.
Not that any of us would.
Yeah, right, and piranhas were vegetarians. What is this gift? I demanded. The Fae extended a gold arm cuff, etched with silver, flashing with ruby fire.
The cuff of Krush. It was made long ago for one of his prized human concubines. It permits a shield of sorts against many unseelie and other unsavory things.
What about the seelie? Does it work against them? It shook its frighteningly beautiful head. I thought a minute. Would it keep me safe from the royal hunters? I asked.
Yes.
Really? I exclaimed. I could want it for that alone. Ever since I'd heard of the devil-like hunters, the mere thought of them made my skin crawl, as if a special fear of that caste of unseelie beyond all others was programmed into my much-preyed-upon genes. What's the catch? I asked. A stupid question, I knew, as if it would tell me. I couldn't trust a thing it said. I had not forgotten Barron's comment that seelie and unseelie royalty were nearly impossible to tell apart. Though this Prince Blaine of the Tour de Dunna claimed to be here on the Seelie Queen's behalf, I had no proof of that, nor even that it was who and what it claimed to be.
There is no catch,
it said. Like I said, stupid question. I stand with my initial position, I informed it. No, thank you. There, that's done. Now let's get to the point. What do you want from me? I yanked my shirt back down. I wanted our little job offer interview over and done with, the sooner the better. The air around me chilled as if iced by the Fae's displeasure with my attitude.
There is trouble in Faerie, Shesir. And as you have seen, in your world as well. After an eternity of confinement, some of the lower caste unseelie have begun escaping their prison. Despite our efforts to isolate the weakness in the fabric of our realms, we have not been able to determine how they are breaking free.
I shrugged. So what do you want me to do about it?
Queen Avil wants the Shesadu, Shesir.
I was beginning to think it might be easier to start tallying everyone I knew in Dublin that didn't want the Shesadu. Gee, that would be nobody. Well, what's stopping her from getting it? Isn't she supposed to be the most powerful of all the Fae? I was pretty sure that was what Barons had told me. Except for the Unseelie King, who some claimed outranked all, while others contended he was a mere figurehead, that the children of the goddess Danu were a matriarchal line. According to Barons, nobody really knew anything for sure about the Unseelie King.
We have a small difficulty. We are unable to sense our own sacred objects. It is only the rare Shesir who can. We do not know where it is.
The Fae could not have seemed more affronted by its admission. How dare the world not bow and scrape at its feet? How dare the universe not conspire to arrange everything in its favor? How dare a mere human possess an ability that was beyond theirs?
Other things have gone missing as well that we would like to recover.
And just what does she want me to do about it? I didn't like where things seemed to be going. I wasn't certain I could survive it.
She merely wishes you to continue searching as you have been, and from time to time we will check on your progress. Should you learn anything, however small, about any of our hallowed relics, especially the Shesadu, you will alert me immediately.
I sighed with relief. I had been afraid it was planning to stay around while I searched. Thank God it wasn't. How am I supposed to do that? Again it offered me the cuff of Krush.
With this, I will show you how to use it.
I shook my head. I'm not taking it.
Don't be a fool. Your world is suffering too.
I have only your word for any of this. For all I know, you're lying about everything, and that cuff might just kill me the instant I put it on.
By the time you find proof that satisfies you, Shesir, it may well be too late for your race.
That's not my problem, I retorted. I never wanted to be a Shesir, and I'm not even admitting that I am one now. In college, I'd known a few people with superhero aspirations who'd wanted to make a difference, join the Peace Corps, or become doctors and cut people open so they could fix them and sew them back up again. But personally, I'd never had any desire to save the world. Decorate it? Yes. Save it? No. Until a short time ago, I'd been a small-town girl with small-town dreams and perfectly content with my lot in life. Then someone had crapped on my world and forced me out of my happy little hole. I'd come to Dublin with a single purpose at heart, to avenge my sister's death. Then and only then could I return to Ashford with some kind of closure for Mom and Dad. Then maybe we could heal and try to be a family again. That was the only world I cared about saving, mine.
You will change your mind,
it said. The Fae was gone. I stared blankly for several moments at the space it had been occupying before snapping out of it. Despite the recent horrors I'd witnessed, I wasn't in the least inured, and watching something vanish right before my eyes had been profoundly disturbing. I glanced around to make sure it hadn't popped back in behind me to sneak up on me or anything like that, but I was alone on the street. I was startled to realize the temperature in my immediate vicinity had dropped so significantly that I could see my breath in the air. A thin perimeter of fog encased me some 20 feet away, where iced air met heat again. I would soon learn it was characteristic of royalty. Their pleasure or displeasure often reshaped the environment in small ways around them. I did another quick scan. Yes, the street was empty, all the doors were closed, and there wasn't a soul around. As fiercely ashamed of myself as I was aroused, I slipped a hand down my jeans. I came the moment I touched myself. 14. It was 8:15 by the time I made it back to the bookstore. I knew Barron's was there as soon as I turned the corner. His big black and chrome hog was parked outside the brilliantly spotlighted front, playing kissing cousins with Fiona's sedate sedan. I rolled my eyes. My day continued to cruise downhill. I'd been hoping that Fiona had left on time, before Barron's had arrived, and before she could rat me out. No such luck. I detoured around back, deciding I would sneak in from the rear, pretend to have been upstairs all day, with my iPod on in case anyone claimed to have knocked, and see if I could pull it off. You never knew what you could get away with until you tried. Maybe nobody had bothered checking on me. When I rounded the rear of the building, my gaze automatically shot to the end of the alley, past the store, to the dark perimeter of the abandoned neighborhood beyond the rear floodlights. I paused, searching for shadows that shouldn't be there. A humorless smile curved my lips. The strangest things were becoming instinctive. I spotted 4 clusters of darkness that were wrong. 3 clung to the shadowy eaves of a building 2 doors down on the right. The 4th was on my left and behaving far more boldly. It was creeping back and forth along the stone foundation of the shop directly adjacent to Barron's, shooting and retracting dark tendrils of itself, testing the edges of the pool of light flooding the rear entrances. All 4 of them pulsed hungrily at my approach. "Stay to the light," Barron's had told me, "and you will be safe. The shades can only get you in full darkness. They are unable to tolerate even the smallest amount of light. You must never, Miss Lane, ever enter the abandoned neighborhood at night." "Well, why doesn't somebody go in there during the day and fix all those broken street lamps?" I had asked. "Wouldn't that get rid of them? Or at least help?"
"The city has forgotten that section exists,"
he had replied.
You will not find a district of the Garda that claims it, and if you ask city power or water, they will have no record of service to any address within its bounds.
I had snorted. Cities don't just lose entire neighborhoods. That's impossible. He had smiled faintly.
In time, Miss Lane, you will cease using that word.
As I climbed the steps to the rear door, I raised my fist and shook it angrily at the shades. I'd had my fill of monsters for the night. The shade that was creeping along the foundation startled me by bristling visibly back at me. I found its display of sentient hostility chilling, and shivered. The rear door was locked, but the third window I tried slid up easily. I muttered beneath my breath about Barron's appalling lack of safety consciousness as I boosted myself up and over the sill. After a quick bathroom stop, I headed for the front of Barron's Books and Baubles. I don't know what made me hesitate when I went to open that second door that separated residence from store, but something did. Maybe I heard my name as I was reaching for the knob, or my curiosity was piqued by the urgent undertone in Fiona's voice that was carrying clearly through the door, although her words did not. Whatever the reason, rather than betray my presence, I nudged the door slightly ajar, pressed my ear to the crack, and displayed a dearth of manners that would have appalled every woman in my family 10 generations back. I eavesdropped on the conversation taking place beyond it.
"You have no right, Jericho, and you know it," Fiona cried.
"When will you learn, Fio?"
Barron said.
"Might makes right. That's all the right I need."
"She doesn't belong here. You can't let her stay. I won't stand for it."
"You won't stand for it? When did you become my keeper, Fio?"
There was danger in the very gentleness with which Barron's asked his question, but Fiona either didn't hear it or chose not to heed it.
"When you started needing one. It's not safe to have her here, Jericho. She must go tonight, if possible, tomorrow at the very latest. I can't be here all the time to make sure nothing happens."
"No one asked you to,"
Barron said coldly.
"Well, someone needs to,"
she cried.
"Jealous, Fio. It doesn't become you."
Fiona sucked in an audible breath. I could almost see her standing there, eyes bright with passion, two spots of color high on the cheekbones of her aging movie star face.
"If you must take this to a personal level, then yes, Jericho, I am. You know I don't want her here. But it's not just about me and what I want. That child is as ignorant and innocent as the day is long. Okay, I really resented that. And she doesn't have the slightest idea what she's doing. She has no notion of the danger she's in, and you have no right to continue placing her in it."
"Not right, Fio. Might. Remember, I'm not interested in rights. I never have been."
"I don't believe that, Jericho. I know you."
"No, Fio. You only think you know me. You really don't know me at all. Stay out of this, or leave. I'm sure I can find another to—"
He paused a moment, as if searching for precisely the right words.
"Serve my needs."
"Oh! Serve your— Oh! Is that what I do? Serve your needs? You'd do that, too, wouldn't you? Find someone else. Just pack me off on the nearest train. I bet you wouldn't even say goodbye, would you? You'd probably never even think of me again."
Barron's laughed softly, and although I couldn't see either of them, I pictured him taking her by the shoulders, maybe brushing his knuckles to the pale, soft curve of her cheek.
"Fio,"
he said.
"My foolish, sweet, faithful Fio. There will always be a place for you in my thoughts. But I am not the man you believe me to be. You have romanticized me unforgivably."
"I have never seen any more in you than I know you could be if you wanted to, Jericho,"
Fiona declared fervently. And even I, a child as ignorant and innocent as the day was long, to coin a recently minted phrase, could hear the blind conviction of love in her voice. Barron's laughed again.
"And there, my dear Fio, you make one of womankind's greatest mistakes, falling in love with a man's potential. We so rarely share the same view of it, and even more rarely care to achieve it. Stop pining for the man you think I could be, and take a good, long, hard look at the one I am.
In my mind, Barons grabbed her when he emphasized the word look, and was now shaking her, not quite so gently. There was another silence, then a sharp, pained, feminine gasp, and a much longer silence.
"She stays, Fio,"
Barons murmured after some time.
"And you will keep your peace about it, won't you?"
I was beginning to think I'd missed her reply when Barons spoke again, harshly.
"I said, won't you, Fio?"
"Of course, Jericho," Fiona replied softly. "Whatever you wish." Her voice was dreamy, as carefree as a child's. Taken aback by her sudden, drastic change of heart, I closed the door with careful stealth. Then I turned and beat a hasty path for the dubious security of my borrowed bedroom. Later that evening, hours after Barons had come to yell at me through my closed door for going out today and risking the safety of his personal oop detector, then gone, yes, Fiona had ratted me out, I stood at my bedroom window and stared out into the night. There was no order to my thoughts. They jumbled and tumbled like autumn leaves in a whirlwind. Where was Alina's journal? There was no way she hadn't been keeping one. If she'd thought she was falling in love, she would have written page after page about her new boyfriend every night, especially if she'd not been talking to me or anyone else about him. Though I'd been considering asking Barons to help me search for it, after the conversation I'd just overheard, that was a big, fat no. Nor was I about to confide in him about my little visit from the Death by Sex Fae. Was Blaine really a Seely prince? The proverbial guy in the white hat? It sure didn't seem like it. But then, would any fae ever seem good to a she-seer? Not that I was admitting that I was one or anything. I was still holding out hope that something else was going on, like maybe I was sleeping and stuck in a long, awful nightmare that would end if only I could wake up. Or maybe I'd been hit by a car and was lying in a hospital bed back in Ashford, having coma-induced hallucinations. Anything would be preferable to calling myself a she-seer. It felt like an admission of defeat, a willful embracing of the strange dark fever I seemed to have caught the moment I'd set foot in Ireland. The craziness had begun that very night with the fae at the bar and the batty old woman. In retrospect, I could see the old woman hadn't been crazy. She'd been a she-seer, and she'd actually saved my life that night. Who could say how things might have turned out if she hadn't stopped me from betraying myself? "Honor your bloodline," she had said. What bloodline? A bloodline of she-seers? Every question I thought of only bred a host of other questions. Did that mean my mom was supposed to be one, too? That thought was simply ludicrous. I couldn't see Rainy Lane, spatula in one hand, dish towel in the other, pretending not to see the Fae any more than I could see Malouche forgiving me for stealing his stone and inviting me along on a shopping trip for the latest in shabby chic golf fashions. Nor could I see my tax attorney father faking Fae blindness. My thought bounced back to Blaine. What if the Fae was lying and was actually an Unseely, working to free more of his brethren to prey upon my world? And if it was telling me the truth, why did the Seely Queen want the book containing the deadliest of all magic? What did Avil plan to do with it, and how had this highly sought-after book gotten lost in the first place? Who could I trust? Where could I turn? Had Alina known any of what I was learning? Had she been to McCabe's and Malouche's? What had happened to her when she'd first arrived in Dublin all those months ago? Whatever it was, when it had begun, she had found it exciting. Had she met a man who'd dragged her into this dark underworld as I had? Had she met a fae who seduced her into it? "He's been lying to me all along," she'd said. "He's one of them." By them, had she meant fae? "Oh, God," I whispered, stunned by the thought. Had Alina thought she was in love with a fae? Had it wooed her, used her? Had she been an oop detector, too, and a null like me? Was I unwittingly following the same steps she'd taken, down the same path, to the same eventual destination? Death? I mentally tallied everyone that was looking for the Shisadu. There was Barons, McCabe, Malouche, Vlaine, and, according to Vlaine, the Seelie Queen, and from the presence of the Unseelie watchdogs at McCabe's and Malouche's, at least one big bad Unseelie that might or might not be called the Lord Master. Why? What were all these, people, for lack of a better word, after? Did they all want it for the same reason? And if so, what was that reason?